the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our first guest this morning is Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum, who's a research physical scientist in the Hydrological Science Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight in Greenbelt, Maryland. Her work includes advancement of a regional landslide forecasting system. She also continues to work on the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, which includes a satellite that can CT scan the inside of a hurricane. Dr. Kirschbaum also works with NASA's disaster programs, which bring satellite data and other products to natural hazard events to improve situational awareness and inform decision-making. And finally, Dahlia has provided a video produced by NASA that will help us understand the tools they use to better understand the formation and the behavior of Atlantic hurricanes. We have placed this video on KPCW's Facebook page, so you can take a look at it this morning. Dahlia Kirschbaum, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's so fun to be back.
Oh, it's great to have you back. And for our listeners not familiar with the GPM mission, can you describe it for all of us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So NASA has a lot of science, exciting science that we're doing. If you've heard the news recently, we're going back to the moon with a mission called Artemis. We're exploring other planets. But the work that I do is focused on how satellites and instruments can look down at Earth to take the pulse of our planet. So one of those satellites was launched in 2014. It was a partnership between NASA and the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, and it's called the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, or GPM. And so it is just celebrated its fifth birthday earlier this year. The instruments are specifically designed to look at precipitation from the ground to the top of the atmosphere, and we are finding out some really exciting things about this satellite and how it works with a network of international satellites to give us rain and snow information everywhere around the world every 30 minutes.
Yeah, and we were with you 5 years ago right after it was launched, and you were going through your shakedown of the instrumentation packages, and it's been exciting to watch the progress. The 2019 Atlantic season for hurricanes began June 1st. It buttons up, hopefully, November 30. What sort of things have we learned recently about precipitation and hurricanes? And what do you think we have in store for us this season?
Well, while I can't make kind of projections about what this hurricane season might bring, what we're learning from our satellite observations is by being able to take a three-dimensional profile, or like a CAT scan of the storm, as you said before, we are able to understand what fuels this storm, how things called latent heat release and other energy-producing activities kind of fuel this storm like a car engine. And so by being able to look at the precipitation in the inner eyes of the storm, or the eye wall of the storm, which is the most intense precipitation, all the way out to the rain bands, we can start to understand why these storms intensify the way that they do, when they do it. And these are important tools for the weather prediction and hurricane prediction teams at NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and National Weather Service and National Hurricane Center to really understand and predict where these storms might move and impact people.
Dahlia, if you could back up a moment and talk about the key ingredients that make up a hurricane and how do they form, where do they come from? I know in the Atlantic they're coming across from sub-Saharan Africa, and I know it has to do with warm water, evaporation, but I know you have a great way of explaining it.
Sure, I'd be happy to talk a bit about that. Just to back up even further, though, some people might be wondering, you know, what's the difference between like a hurricane and a typhoon? And actually, there isn't anything different. It's just a matter of where they are. So tropical cyclones is kind of the catch-all term, and they're named different things depending on where you are. So in the Atlantic and Eastern Pacific, they're called hurricanes. In the Western Pacific, they're called typhoons. And in the Indian Ocean, they're called cyclones. And so all of those types of phenomena require a couple key ingredients. And as you mentioned, warm ocean water, moist, humid air, and some existing storms. And so what happens is the warm air starts to rise, and the humidity rises, and then other air starts to rush in at the ocean surface to take that place. It's an area of low pressure. And so then it starts to move faster, and the warm air moves up and gets wetter and starts to rise, and it starts forming clouds and precipitation. And so at once it hits a point in the atmosphere, it kind of fans out, and you start to move through this energy release that starts to make it move faster. And based on the warm surface water, it provides the fuel, just like a car engine does, to drive this hurricane and make it more intense. And then, of course, because the Earth rotates, these storms start to rotate as they intensify. And that's where we see this key signature from space of this eye of the storm, and then the strong winds and rain that are rotating around it.
There was a great metaphor on the NASA website talking about the circular nature of the storm and the eye wall of the storm, likening it to a figure skater that pulls his or her arms in to be able to rotate faster. And can you explain how it begins to rotate faster and faster and gather more energy?
Sure. So the fuel for this, or the momentum for this type of storm, requires this kind of deep pool of warm water. And so it all is based on how water changes state, from going from a liquid to a gas, evaporating, and then condensing again. And so as that that cycle starts to move faster and faster, we're able to start to see this rotation of the storm moving faster and faster as well. So it's changing in pressure between the center of the storm and the outside, and from the surface of the ocean to high altitudes. And I think one important thing to kind of bring this back to what NASA can contribute is we have satellites and constellations of satellites, not just the GPM satellite, that can look at precipitation, understand what we call latent heating that really fuels and intensifies these storms. But we also have constellations like Cygnus, which looks at GPS signals that are scattered off the ocean to infer what the wind speeds look like based on the waves. And then we have other satellites, you mentioned where these storms form, you know, that can look at the dust coming off of Africa that are forming really the beginnings of many of these storms. And so by being able to kind of look at Earth as a system and then model it with the different satellite information and models that we have at NASA, we really are starting to, you know, get a much better understanding for why hurricanes intensify the way that they do, and ultimately where they might go and impact, land.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Dalia Kirschbaum, who's a research physical scientist in the Hydrological Sciences Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight in Greenbelt, Maryland. Dalia, and I want to point our listeners again to our Facebook page, where Dalia has given us a video that's been produced by NASA that will help you even understand further the complexity of formation and behavior, understanding formation and behavior of Atlantic hurricanes, all hurricanes. Dalia, there's a direct relationship between moisture, precipitation in the air, and energy. And if the oceans are warming and there's more energy in the atmosphere, I know we're not going to be talking about forecasting, but does that lend itself to having stronger hurricanes?
Yeah. So if you have more, moist air, if you have deeper and warmer water, looking at how hurricanes and tropical cyclones in general may be impacted by in our changing climate, what researchers do estimate is that we might have stronger storms. So maybe not more frequent. The jury is still out on exactly that relationship. But we believe that there will be more extreme storms, so more storms like Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, these big behemoth of storms, just because there's more energy to feed these storms when they're developing over the ocean.
And with these storms, I suppose there could be more precipitation coming down and making landfall. So that would contribute to the landslides part of it, where landslides could be more frequent.
That's right, and that's actually research that I'm working on. And so, by being able to understand where and when it might rain, we can understand, where we have extreme impacts like landslides and flooding. And so we're working at NASA to bring together satellite precipitation information along with surface information we can get from satellites, like how steep it is in the topography, how what the land cover looks like. Has it recently been deforested or no more trees? And then we can also look at other things like what do the rocks look like? What does the soil look like? And that can give us clues into understanding, you know, in real-time terms, where landslides may be possible. But what's interesting is NASA also has data sets with its partners and others to look at the impact. So we're just starting to do more research into not only where landslides might be happening, but how populations may be exposed to them, you know, where landslides may impact people or infrastructure like buildings or roads. And that's really important information for responders, first responders to some of these big events, to know where, you know, roads might be blocked, where they might need to provide aid more quickly or mobilize helicopters. And this is an area of active research working with partners around the world to advance our understanding.
Dahlia, I know you hail from Minnesota or some very flat state like that. It's Minnesota, right?
Indeed. Yes, it is.
And so,
very good.
So obviously you became interested in landslides after you left your homeland, where there is more there's an incline. But this is interesting. I was driving down the highway the other day, I-15 in Montana, but it was a very flat area. And this happens quite often. You just see this random slide from the road cut. And I've always wondered what made this bit of land slide. And it was just an observation. And also, you know, it ties into the Department of Transportation and how they do their road cuts. And this was just a very small hill, like, you know, maybe it was 50 feet high or something that they had to make the road cut for. I just thought that was interesting. And, you know, is this sort of modeling something that Departments of Transportation can use to know how to better cut their roads?
Yeah, well, I think there's different scales at which we're looking. You know, looking at an individual, you know, small hill, as you mentioned, is something that is important for engineers, road construction groups, departments of transportation to really understand. What we're doing is a little bit bigger picture just because of the nature of the types of data with which we're working. But it's important to note, as you mentioned, that landslides happen in all 50 states. And they can be caused by extreme rainfall. They can be caused by long-term accumulation of rainfall. So, for example, that's some of the reasons why the OSO Washington landslide, which is one of the most deadly landslides in recent U.S. history, occurred, was after, you know, a season of heavy rainfall. And then other things like earthquakes and even road construction and human activities, all of those can drive landslide activity. And so we're working with groups such as the U.S. Geological Survey and state surveys to really understand those processes. But another important part of this is to really know where they are. And that seems pretty obvious, but it's really hard. So we have been working at NASA to develop a citizen science tool so people can report landslides in their area, such as the road you were driving on in Montana. And so if you want to learn more about that, it's at landslides.nasa.gov, and a tool called Landslide Reporter, we're actually having a paper released in a week or so, can really help us to pinpoint where these events are happening and ultimately help us to better model the hazard associated with them, because there's a lot we still don't know.
And so what you're saying is when it comes to landslides, you're still relying on anecdotal evidence, and the mathematical modeling is not or is it a great predictor of it? Because I'm just thinking about that landslide in Washington that you were speaking of. I can't remember what the predictability of that was.
Well, we're making great strides. And in some regions, the U.S. Geological Survey and state surveys have installed local warning systems or local modeling systems. But we don't have a U.S.-wide landslide warning system at all. And so the goal is really to really improve different parts of the equation, if you will, you know, where are these events happening so we can evaluate how well we can resolve them. And then work with the local agencies to get a better understanding in terms of the engineering of the slopes and how, you know, they can take information on past landslides, as well as surface cover and other information that's publicly available from satellites or available from state or local surveys to really improve our understanding. So there's a lot of different ways to go about this, and we're trying to address all of them in time.
Next month is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. So many of us are not only thinking about this spectacular event, but also what was going on in July of 1969. When we go back there from a forecasting perspective, what sort of technology did we have? What was our ability to understand formation and behavior of hurricanes back then compared to now?
That's a great question. I mean, so the satellite era really started in the 60s in terms of being able to start to look at the tops of clouds. And since then, you know, the first pictures from space, which are now routine, you know, on our social media feeds of the eyes of storms, you know, we have so many tools over the last several decades to observe these storms from space using, you know, satellites that are 22,000 miles away, but taking continuous pictures of our surface and the atmosphere, to the International Space Station and satellites that are in that similar, what we call low Earth orbit, that can really peer inside these types of storms and the conditions that may generate them. But I think one of the most important and exciting developments, especially of recent time, is the establishment and the improvement of models, right? Because we can't observe everything all the time, all of the different variables. And so, and in fact, there's some things we will never be able to measure from satellites, but we can use models to piece together the parts and to get a better, more holistic view of these storms. And so I think that is, you know, looking towards the future, we're going to continue to advance our estimates and observations and making sure we have long records to evaluate them. But models are really, moving us forward to improve the predictability of not just storms, but the impacts of them for disasters in general.
There's so much data out there, so I know we're developing algorithms to be able to take a look at that data in different ways, and we may come up with things that we've never even expected to come up with. Is that correct?
I think so. I think, you know, with this, you know, idea of big data and so much information out there, how can we harness it using different tools and techniques, and then, you know, using citizens and groups that are interested in learning more, such as your listeners, to provide, you know, checkpoints on the ground for how much it's raining or when there's been a landslide. In fact, right now there's actually a NASA-wide citizen science meeting taking place in Tucson to really talk about how we can push the boundary of not just, you know, big data and modeling, but also how we can involve everyday, you know, people in finding and learning more about science, both into the cosmos and here on Earth. And so I think this is also an exciting area that that we're just starting to, you know, evolve our capabilities to handle.
I just wanted to add a short comment that none of this is routine to me when I look at these pictures. And when I look at GPM's analysis as they're slicing through these hurricanes and the granularity and the detail and the data that is there, it'll never be routine to me. I'm just fascinated by it.
Well, I am too. That's why I do this for a living. It's a great place to work.
I'll bet it is.
You know, when you mentioned, Dahlia, the citizen scientist meeting in Texas, it occurred to me just as you were talking, I wonder how many citizens go on to NASA.gov and just explore the website. I'm sure you have a lot of, you know, space geeks and citizen scientists who just love this stuff. But for the average person, how do you attract more people? Because I find the NASA website to be fascinating.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a great question. We, NASA.gov has millions and millions of viewers every day, and the social media accounts do as well, have millions of followers. In terms of, you know, if you're interested in Earth science, the NASA Earth Twitter account has, again, millions of followers. But something that's a little bit closer to what I do is actually a page called disasters.nasa.gov, and that helps to identify how NASA is helping to provide information for different disasters around the world. And there's, for people who are interested in digging into the data, which is all free and open, there's a portal that can do that. But this starts to kind of weave a narrative of how the different observations and ground information that we can have at NASA can really inform emergency responders. It can inform, you know, recovery efforts. And so NASA, you know, has a global reach. We have a global footprint. And our goal is really to enable many of these operational agencies and groups around the world to use data to make informed decisions about disaster response. And so that's something recently that I've really been focusing on and promoting, because I think that there's so much information, as you said, out there. And so trying to distill it into something that's really relevant for the individual person can be a little daunting. So if people are interested in disasters like I am, I would check out disasters.nasa.gov.
That sounds great. We'll put a link to that on our website as well, because that sounds like a lot of fun. We have a local hydrologist that works with the National Weather Service, or NOAA, and he's into debris flows, especially in southern Utah when we get the heavy rains in the slot canyons and this flow of debris, which I guess that's a certain type of landslide.
Oh yeah, absolutely it is.
Yeah, but I'm sure he's on this site all the time. I just wanted to mention there's a group that out of Bozeman, Montana that we've talked to a couple times called Adventure Scientists. And what they do is they have this network where they go out to people who are doing various adventures. Maybe you're climbing Mount Everest, and they get you to sign on as a sort of a citizen scientist and gather data from wherever it is on the planet that you're going. And I just thought that's a really interesting point to mention, because you also at NASA rely on these types of reportings.
Exactly. I mean, I think that, you know, what's important for people to understand is that, you know, the way that we view things from space, right? How land cover is changing, how much it's raining, what do our oceans look like? You know, there's advanced technologies for us to do that. But what's very important is to check that we're right, right? To check that what we're viewing is actually true. And so we have a number of different ways to do that. And one of them is, you know, leveraging and making use of this type of information from adventure scientists. There's another program in schools called GLOBE, which is with working with schools around the world and different applications to look at clouds, to look at land cover and precipitation and soil moisture, for example. And so that type of data is taken routinely by students, where they learn about these processes. But then the data is provided for scientific use, and it's used by, you know, researchers around the world. And so this is an exciting way to engage, you know, students in this data process and ultimately data analysis, which is, you know, how we learn math and science, which obviously are the building blocks to advancing our capabilities scientifically and technologically.
Dahlia, GPM's just had its fifth year as an anniversary, being up in the air and providing information for us. And I think since that time, a couple of GOES-class satellites have been put up as well. What's it look like for the future for additional technology or for additional satellites that may be going up there to complement this array of collaborating satellites that are all sharing information?
Well, NASA in 2017 launched a decadal survey, and they came out with the results of this survey. And so, what this is intended to do is an independent group of scientists and engineers that identify and highlight what NASA's priorities should be in Earth science in the next 10 years. And so, one of the most important things that they view as being an emphasis is both continuity and advancing our understanding of precipitation. Convection, so how clouds and those types of storms develop, and aerosols, so really the building blocks of some of these storms. And so I was just at a meeting last week that's talking about new missions to really understand these processes, as you said, working together with existing capabilities. And so the goal is really to understand the processes that take a storm from this tiny dust molecule or series of dust, you know, particles coming off of Africa and turning them into a superstorm that hits, or Category 5 storm that hits the East Coast. And so these types of advanced groundbreaking instruments and data are going to be critical for moving us into that realm. And so it's exciting, and hopefully the launch will be in, or launches will be in the later 2020s. And so hopefully I can come back on your show and talk more about it then, or before.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have you back. Dahlia, before we let you go, I just wanted to mention that we found this great little video on the NASA website that talks about the faces of those who work in your field. And there's a little highlight video on you and how you got into doing what you do. And we're going to post that on our page as well, because it's really great and an inspiration for especially young women about pursuing in science and math and tying it into real world problems.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I love what I do. You know, I started with a foundation, a solid foundation in math and science, but you know, where I am now at NASA has enabled me to pursue things like, where can we understand power outages in Puerto Rico, to where might landslides being occur in Chile and Colombia, to what are the mechanisms that drive storms, you know, hitting the Philippines. And so, you know, if that interests you, that kind of applied work, you know, I think it's really exciting to, as an adult, go in and learn about the science, and as a student and, you know, trying to decide what to do, you know, getting a foundation in math and science so you can be the next generation to answer these questions is going to be absolutely crucial. So happy to talk more about that, but thanks so much.
Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum, research physical scientist at the Hydrological Sciences Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight in Greenbelt, Maryland, next to my alma mater in College Park. We want to thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you back. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.